The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The U.S. Supreme Court says the president's finances are fair game. And the European bank that holds most of those records? Well, it's got a reputation.
Just about every offense under the sun, ranging from money laundering to tax evasion, ripping off investors, ripping off governments, and doing business with kind of a who's who of bad people.
Donald Trump and Deutsche Bank, today on The World. Also, documenting recent police violence against protesters around the globe and here in the U.S.
It was little towns, Conway, Arkansas, Fort Wayne, Indiana. It was just incredible how widespread and pervasive it was.
And no screaming on the roller coaster, please. I'm Carol Hills. That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The U.S. Supreme Court weighed in today on the question of presidential power, and in a big way. The justices decided 7-2 that prosecutors in New York must be given access to President Trump's financial records. White House lawyers were arguing that Trump should be immune from criminal proceedings, but that argument did not fly. It means executives at financial institutions who've done business with Donald Trump are now going to have to decide how to respond. Deutsche Bank, headquartered in Frankfurt, Germany, is one of them. David Enrich is the author of a new book called Dark Towers: Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and an epic trail of destruction. David Enrich joins us now from New York. David, tell me about the relationship between Donald Trump and Deutsche Bank. They go back a long way, right?
Yeah, they go back nearly two decades at this point. And for Donald Trump, he was basically a pariah in the banking world for a very long time because of his tendency to default on loans and stiff his business partners. And Deutsche Bank, starting in the late 1990s, was the one mainstream financial institution that was consistently willing to do business with Trump. And so over a period of many years, the bank lent him more than $2 billion. And currently with him in the White House, he still owes the bank more than $300 million in debt to the bank.
What kind of reputation does Deutsche Bank have?
Very, very bad. The bank's been around for 150 years with a brief interruption when it was the Nazi Party's bank of choice. And in the past 20 years or so, the bank became a much bigger player on Wall Street and became, frankly, just much greedier, really pursued short-term profits above absolutely everything else. And as a direct consequence, the bank got in all sorts of trouble for just about every offense under the sun, money laundering to tax evasion, violating international sanctions, ripping off its customers, ripping off investors, ripping off governments, and doing business with kind of a who's who of bad people, whether it was Jeffrey Epstein or Russian oligarchs or alleged terrorist organizations.
So Deutsche Bank's done a lot of business with Donald Trump. Presumably they have a lot of records on Trump's financial life. What does Deutsche Bank know?
Deutsche Bank knows just about everything there is to know about Donald Trump's finances, really. I mean, they have tax returns of Trump's companies and family members. They are able to identify the shell companies that are used by Trump and his business partners around the world to move money. And they also have detailed records about potentially suspicious transactions that have taken place in the Trump accounts. That's something that we know about because there have been some whistleblowers who have tried to raise red flags and were thwarted by the bank. So it really represents a huge treasure trove of the president's financials.
Why did Deutsche Bank tell a federal court last October that it did not have Trump's tax returns?
That is a very good question. The odd thing about this is that as I was reporting on my book, Dark Towers, I talked to people at Deutsche Bank who had personally seen Trump's tax returns in previous years. So the bank did have his tax returns. And if you take it at face value that they no longer do, that means they somehow got rid of them, which my reporting suggests the most likely case is that they returned them to Trump maybe shortly before he became president.
With today's ruling, then, couldn't Deutsche Bank be called upon to release this financial information, including tax returns that so many people would like to see?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, today's rulings are actually a pretty big victory for President Trump. The issue is not settled yet, and it's going to go back to lower courts to kind of hash out the details of how these subpoenas will be enforced and exactly what information needs to be handed over. But the Trump family's goal from the moment these subpoenas were issued last spring has been to delay, delay, delay. And as a result of today's Supreme Court decisions, there is almost zero chance that Deutsche Bank or Mazars, the accounting firm, will hand over anything to anyone before the election. So I think Trump is probably breathing a bit of a sigh of relief right now.
David Enrich, author of the new book, Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and an Epic Trail of Destruction. Thanks a lot, David.
Thanks for having me.
We know that the legal system here in the U.S. can work differently for people who are citizens and those who are not. Now, during the pandemic, those differences can put some immigrants at greater risk, including people just released from prison. The World's Monica Campbell spoke with one of them.
First, I ask how he's feeling.
I woke up all right, but right before you called, I was having a coughing fit. Now, I'm talking to you, I got to lay down on my chest to control it.
Well, if you need a second, take it.
I just need to keep myself on my bed, on my stomach.
Okay. Shantan Bun is in San Francisco, and last week he tested positive for the coronavirus, but his spirits are high.
Oh, I feel great. Even if I have to go through this, it's such a great feeling.
Bun was just released from San Quentin State Prison. He's spent the past 23 years inside, since he was 18, for an armed robbery of a computer store. Nobody was injured. He had braced himself for a far different scenario the day he got out.
The Friday before I was released, ICE came and interviewed me and said they were picking me up.
Bun's from Cambodia. He arrived as a refugee when he was a kid. He has a green card, but his criminal record makes him a target for ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Across the U.S., prison officials normally notify ICE when they are releasing a non-citizen that the agency wants in custody. But things have become more complicated. Transferring people from prisons to immigration detention centers now is incredibly risky and controversial because many of these places are rife with coronavirus. Bun started to feel sick during his last days in San Quentin, and this made his lawyer nervous.
We were deeply concerned, and I was getting letters from Bun as he was watching the outbreak spread around him.
Anoop Prasad is a longtime immigration lawyer in San Francisco.
He was feeling increasingly panicked and felt like a sitting duck sitting in his cell that it was just a matter of time until COVID came and got him.
So the idea that Bun, feeling sick, would be transferred from prison to a crowded detention center seemed wrong.
We knew very well that if he gets transferred to ICE, he very well may infect other people and he very well may not survive.
Prasad and his organization, the Asian Law Caucus, launched a public campaign.
We had been holding rallies and call-in actions.
This seemed to work because when Bun was released from prison, ICE wasn't there to pick him up, which is extremely unusual. Every year, thousands of immigrants are released from prison and put into detention where they face deportation. Immigrant rights activists have been fighting this policy for years, but it's come under renewed scrutiny with the pandemic. Some California lawmakers want the ICE transfers to stop, particularly with the threat of COVID-19. Last week, they grilled the state's top prison official, Rafael Diaz. He defended the practice.
If an individual has served their term and their term is up, and there's a hold or a warrant by ICE as a pickup, they're picked up by ICE just like any other law enforcement agency who may have a hold on an individual to take into their custody for their reasons.
For the moment, Shantan Bun is happy to be out of prison, but he still faces the threat of deportation. So the day he was released, he went straight to a church in San Francisco that offers sanctuary from ICE. For Bun, it feels strange to be hiding out from immigration officials when he spent almost all of his life in the U.S.
This is my country now, too. I've been here since I was a kid. I know everything about this country, so how am I different than you?
He and his family fled the Khmer Rouge's genocide in Cambodia. They resettled in the U.S. as refugees in the 80s. Bun knew relatives who were murdered, and he says it was traumatizing.
I don't think the United States was ready for kids like me. I got in trouble a lot, right? And people didn't understand why. When I was scared, I fought. When I think I could get away, I ran.
He feels he's rehabilitated, but he left a community behind in San Quentin, including other immigrants like himself, people who face twin threats, deportation and now COVID-19.
There's a lot of immune compromised older gentlemen in those buildings, so I'm praying that they survive this.
ICE didn't respond to interview requests for this story. As of now, there's no plan to halt the transfer of immigrants released from prison to the agency. For The World, Monica Campbell.
KALW reporter Nina Ginsler-Debs contributed to this story. Across the U.S., many school districts are still struggling to draw up plans to reopen schools. And with such a sharp surge in COVID cases nationwide, planning even a month ahead isn't such an easy task. But in the U.K., it seems they already have a plan to get kids back to classrooms in September. Tiffany Yates is the head of English at Burlington Danes Academy in White City, London. Tiffany, you recently returned to teaching, although just twice a week. What's it been like? I mean, when you walk into a classroom, what does it look like?
It feels quite strange, to be honest. So we have a maximum of 15 students in a room, and they are all 2 meters apart. And as a teacher, I have to stay at the front of the room all the time, which feels quite odd. So the students have to work very independently. It's been a bit strange as well because they can't take in their work and I can't look at what they've done even after the class is finished.
So how does that work? Do they submit things online so you can actually look at their work?
So we've been asking students to take photos on their mobile phone and then send those and email those through to us. And then we feedback on that in the next lesson. It's not the worst way of working, but it does feel a bit bizarre not to take in books.
And just to be clear, the kids are in school now. Is this kind of making up from last spring, like making up what they missed?
Yes. So the thing I guess that's tricky about it is not all of our students have been able to return. We only have our year 10 students, so that's the 14, 15-year-olds. And even then, it's only 25% at a time. So the content that we're delivering now, it is stuff that's going to be on the exam, but it's not, it can't be critical stuff because there's a lot of students that aren't actually able to come into school due to shielding. So it's really small groups on site at any one time.
I know that in Britain, safety guidelines have recently been issued by the Department for Education for the greater return to classrooms of children in the fall. And I know they're going to separate children into bubbles to reduce contact between them. And the schools themselves are expected to conduct their own contact tracing. Is this something that schools can manage, in your opinion?
So we're very lucky. We've got a really large school site, so we've been able to isolate students into bubbles. We're going to do that by year group. We have 180 students in each year group, and so we'll have them in lessons only in their year groups, having lunch only in their year groups to kind of reduce the risk of transmission as much as possible. That's not possible for every school. Schools with a smaller site, for example, might find that difficult. In terms of contact tracing, that's easier to manage because generally, due to the timetable, we know who's going to be seeing who when. And in our case, it's only going to be teachers moving around the school, and the teachers are going to be remaining 2 meters plus away from students at all times.
So looking ahead, Tiffany, what are your main concerns ahead of this next school year?
I think firstly, I'm concerned for the pastoral well-being of our students when they come back. A lot of our students have been expressing heightened anxiety. I'm concerned about the longer term impact this will have as well. Our students are already often in an economically vulnerable situation. I think that the longer lasting recession that will come off the back of this crisis is likely to affect them disproportionately more than students in other areas. And finally, I'm concerned about particularly our older students who are on GCSE and A-level courses and have missed large chunks of learning. And that's going to be very difficult to make up in the circumstances, particularly if we have year group lockdowns, for example. So I'm concerned about their academic progress as well.
Do you think schools will need to hire more teachers to manage all these new rules?
Yes. So we've got 3 new people joining us. We're going to increase our department by 3 next year. Even though our classes, the number of classes won't increase, I think the students are going to need more intervention, and both pastoral and academic. And that's why we've increased that teaching team.
Tiffany Yates is the head of English at Burlington Danes Academy in White City, London. Thanks, Tiffany.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. When it comes to climate change solutions, we often focus on the technical stuff, things like renewable energy or fuel efficiency. But let's not forget about art. That's the focus of this week's installment of The World's Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The World's Anna Kussmer is here to speak with me about poetry as a means to confront climate change. Anna, when we think about climate change solutions, poetry and art usually aren't at the top of the list. How could they affect climate change?
The natural sciences and engineering are not nearly enough to actually tackle the immensity of this problem. Climate change is definitely a material problem, but it's also a cultural and a spiritual problem. Poetry and the arts can help us get to those higher level parts of it. Julia Bentz runs a project in Portugal called Art for Adaptation, and they look at the relationship between the arts and climate change. She says so much of tackling climate change is about challenging the deep beliefs that people have about the natural world.
We really need new narratives and new metaphors that are inspiring. I think poetry can be a very powerful tool in that.
It's interesting. I've read a lot of poems about nature, but I don't know if I've read a poem that was specifically about climate change. Is there a lot of that out there?
In the last 10 years, there's actually been a surge of literature about climate change, including poetry. I spoke to Adeline Johns-Putra, who is a literary scholar at the University of Surrey in England, and she says because climate change is such an overwhelming problem, poetry can be this perfect way to confront our complex feelings about it. And she described for me what a good poem does.
Does it give me a chill? You know, does it make my heart stop? Really good poetry, you know, draws you in and then it stops and makes you think. That's an ethical power that's important in a time of climate change. You know, thinking and feeling together as we're taking in all of this information about what's going on.
I asked Johns-Putra about how not just reading, but also writing poetry can help people cope with the emotional weight of climate change.
You know, there is, I think, a therapeutic aspect to it, to writing poetry and sharing it. There is a working through of the trauma, and that's important too.
She says it's a particularly good way for teenagers and young people to connect with climate change as an issue.
And I understand there are people doing that.
Yes, actually, we're partnering with an educational organization called Write the World, and they host a global community of young people who write about the world around them. Director Claire McFadden says that for the writers she works with, there's this global community that's forming around lots of issues, particularly climate change, and that community building has been a really powerful thing.
I think we often frame young people as, oh, young people are the future. I'm like, well, young people are they're here and now, they're citizens of the world right now, and they've got something to say.
For the next few weeks here on The Big Fix, we're going to be bringing some of these young poets to you. And the first poem we're going to hear is from an 18-year-old living in Mumbai.
Let's give it a listen.
My name is Vani Dadu, and I'm speaking to you from 13,000 miles away, from the city of Mumbai. We've been facing our own struggles with climate change, erratic weather, and urbanization. But sometimes, I still find myself in places where something natural just takes my breath away. Climate change is affecting us all in very real and very physical ways. But I think here, I'm talking more about the emotional impact the environment has on me, especially since I live in a jungle of steel. How the trees swinging outside my window just makes me feel happier and more peaceful. So, this is my poem. In my city, if you lie on the roof of a 60-something skyscraper to stargaze, you'd have the proof from the stars, stray and ablaze, that you are still as insignificant. In my city, if you drive on the bridge over the sea that separates cities and mountains, you'd see and wonder at the waves, whelming and wanton, and not at the beams that hold up the bridge. In my city, if you walk along and look at the coast from your house of wood and metal and brick, you'd want to boast that the water tries to worship and lick your feet and your hands and your soul. In my city, if you notice the electric tower rising in the skies, across the highway, the lonely street, you'd recognize an emerald creeper climbing, not discreet, unaware of electricity, but thriving on it. In my city, if you stand on the beach and see the sun drowning in the sea, and behind you there's a row of commercial buildings, you'd agree that the dying red sunlight seems to be gilding the glass windows and the metal girders.
Our story was produced by Uzair Ahmed and Anna Kusmer. It may not sound like the best idea, but some amusement parks here in the U.S. and across the globe are starting to reopen.
On Saturday, the iconic Orlando destination will begin a cautious and phased reopening of its parks after being shut down for 4 months due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Get your summertime fix of cotton candy or the adrenaline rush that comes from a towering roller coaster ride. But the amusement park experience this summer might not be exactly what you remember, as the world's Dano Offman reports.
In fact, the whole experience will feel quite different. Most amusement and theme parks are planning a phased reopening schedule. They'll start slow, with lower attendance levels and new safety and social distance rules. Similar precautions are being taken in parks around the world. In Japan, the Fuji-Q Highland Amusement Park put out this video. It shows two executives riding the Fujiyama roller coaster. It's the park's number one draw, and here comes the drop. It's a wild-looking ride for sure, but here's the thing that's different. Those two executives, they're silent through the whole roller coaster ride. Not a peep, let alone a full-on scream. They're also both wearing masks, by the way, which need to be slightly adjusted at times. But overall, these guys are completely stoic. At the end, the amusement park execs arrive at a stopping point, and then a message appears on the screen. In Japanese, it reads, quote, "Please scream inside your heart." As in, don't scream out loud as you usually would, because that's one way you could spread virus-carrying droplets to your fellow adrenaline seekers. That message, though, scream inside your heart, it sure feels like something we can all relate to, even if we're not in the midst of a 230-foot roller coaster drop. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
Every morning, our team here at The World discuss and debate the most important stories we need to cover. Subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Top of the World, and start your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Hip-hop artist Raja Kumari was born in Los Angeles to Indian immigrants. She moved to India and found more music success there.
You keep telling me that nobody cares and nobody, you know, it won't work here and you're alienating the population. So if America didn't want to give me the platform, I was going to get it.
But things got complicated, too. That story's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH and PRX. Two activists in a part of Louisiana that's nicknamed Cancer Alley are facing serious criminal charges. They were part of a protest action against a Taiwanese petrochemical company called Formosa Plastics Corporation. As reporter Kyle Vass reports, the protest near Baton Rouge has caught the attention of environmental activists in Taiwan.
Formosa Plastics planned to expand its operations into St. James Parish, Louisiana. The company applied for a permit to build a new manufacturing complex there. But as the application was being considered, a judge in Texas found the company guilty of violating the Clean Water Act. Formosa was dumping little plastic pellets called nurdles into Lavaca Bay on the Gulf Coast. For that, Formosa agreed to pay a $50 million settlement. Ann Rolfes is the director of an environmental group called Bucket Brigade Louisiana.
We work with people who live along the region known as Cancer Alley, where there is an enormous concentration of oil refineries and chemical plants. And we help communities either stop new places from being built or halt expansions or take action to clean up their air quality.
Rolfes said she wanted to make a point to the lobbyists pushing for the new plant in Louisiana. So she got a hold of those little plastic nurdles from the Texas case, boxed them up, and left the box outside a lobbyist's home.
It was really pretty harmless, just bringing evidence from Formosa's trial to their front door.
6 months later, Rolfes learned there was a warrant out for her arrest in connection with her leaving that box.
Well, they cited the terrorizing law. I mean, it was my coworker and I, so two of us. They cited terrorizing. And if you read the statute, it says you have to intend to really scare the general public. We intended to deliver evidence to some lobbyists. That was our intent, and we did it. We didn't try to scare anybody, and we're not interested in doing that.
If found guilty, Rolfes could be facing up to 15 years in prison. Activists in St. James Parish say those charges are meant to send a message.
They want to silence us, but they're not going to silence us. They must think we're stupid over here in St. James. But this one woman that's not stupid.
Sharon Levine is the president of an organization called Rise. She says her group was successful in blocking a Chinese company from moving into St. James Parish last year. She believes the authorities are now looking for a reason to arrest her, too.
A lot of my members are afraid to speak up. They're afraid of repercussions. I'm not afraid. I was already been told to, you know, be careful and all that stuff. But I don't have to be that careful because God got me, baby.
There are a total of 140 chemical factories in the region. Levine says they're making people sick.
I don't know anybody in St. James that don't have a health issue. Some people have allergies. Some people have respiratory problems. Some people have asthma. All kind of ailments. The doctor said I have autoimmune hepatitis. And last year, they said I had aluminum in my body. I said, on top of everything, I have something else in my body? Oh, my God.
When I reached out to Formosa Plastics, they sent back a statement. It said the company will work with the community in St. James Parish to address concerns. It went on to say, quote, there are some who are doing everything they can to stop progress in the parish, including spreading fear and confusion, unquote. Formosa Plastics is accused of environmental violations elsewhere, dumping mercury waste in Cambodia, toxic discharge off the coast of Vietnam. Environmental activists in Taiwan say they're well aware of Formosa's track record, and they think the fear in Louisiana is justified.
Formosa is Taiwan's historical name, which means something like a beautiful island. So, to me, it's kind of personal that they are doing such things in the name of Formosa.
Xu Huiting is an activist based in the Taiwanese capital of Taipei.
Right now, like Americans are saying no Formosa, and it does sound, I don't know, sad and heartbreaking to me, kind of. But I know that they're doing it for a reason, because what Formosa Plastic has done.
Another Taiwanese activist, Lin Yanting, says there was a telling incident last year in a part of rural Taiwan. A complex run by Formosa Plastics exploded, he says, and thousands of residents had to be evacuated. Lin says the explosion was about a half mile wide and dropped pollution from the sky on nearby homes, farms, and fisheries. He says Yunlin is one of Taiwan's most important farming areas, and the blast had a huge effect on the agriculture industry. Lin and Xu both say they're nervously watching Louisiana, hoping that Formosa Plastics will not be allowed to build a new plant in St. James Parish.
I can say that I know people from the community showing solidarity with St. James Parish community.
Whether it's Southeast Asia or the Gulf Coast of Louisiana, Xu says that she hopes activists won't give up their fight for environmental protections. For The World, I'm Kyle Vass.
Here's what downtown Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, sounded like last night. Demonstrators there were protesting the government's handling of the coronavirus outbreak, and for a second night in a row, police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd. Since 2020 began, there have been demonstrations all over the world, Iraq, the UK, Hong Kong, South Korea, and of course, protests here in many American cities, large and small. We're going to talk about protests and police with Brian Kastner. He's an investigator for Amnesty International, and he led a team that looked at how police handled protests in the U.S. following the killing of George Floyd. Hi, Brian.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know your team analyzed 500 videos taken between May 26th and June 5th of police and protesters across the U.S. Give us the headline. What was the interaction like?
Well, what we saw is that, you know, there was just violence everywhere. And I think that the very low threshold of police to use violence when they could have used other means or even speak to people, that's really what was incredible and shocking. And also that the violence was very widespread. So out of those 500 videos, we narrowed it down to 125 specific incidents in 40 states in the District of Columbia across those 10 days, like you said. And it wasn't just New York and LA and Seattle. It was little towns, Conway, Arkansas, Fort Wayne, Indiana. It was just incredible how widespread and pervasive it was.
And what kind of violence are we talking about? You're talking about violence perpetrated by police or violence among everyone?
That's a good question. So we were looking specifically at cases where police unlawfully used violence or used force when they didn't have to. And so certainly some of these protests were violent. Some protests turned into riots. But we were focused on incidents, for example, like in Huntington Beach, California, where protesters were laying down in the street to protest, laying on their stomachs, and the police just start shooting at them with pepper balls in that particular case. But there were a number one of these where the protests were completely peaceful, and whether it was because a curfew was hit or because police just decided they needed to clear the road or something, where these peaceful protesters were met with violence in really just kind of extraordinarily inappropriate ways.
I want to drill down a little. And first, the question, of course, is where did you get the videos and how do you verify their authenticity?
So we are trolling social media. We're looking at Reddit. We're looking at TikTok, Facebook, Twitter. These are videos that are usually put up by people themselves. Sometimes it was news reports, local TV channels that were putting stuff up. But the majority was what we call user-generated content. And then we go through a process where we determine when it happened to make sure it's not old, to make sure where it happened, specific dates and locations. I mean, these are the same techniques we would use to figure out where an airstrike occurred in Libya, for instance, except now we're using clues in the background of these videos to confirm that, yes, this really did happen in Richmond, Virginia at a certain time and place and on a specific day.
Now, you've studied police actions against protesters in other countries. Give some examples, because, of course, what I'm getting at is trying to compare police response in a fair way.
Absolutely. So, for example, I was in Hong Kong last year documenting those protests. And what we saw in Hong Kong a lot was the misuse of tear gas, firing tear gas in confined spaces, firing tear gas in places where the crowd couldn't disperse. There's no point in firing tear gas at a crowd if there's no way for them to leave, if they're trapped. And we saw that all the time in Hong Kong. And unfortunately, we saw that as well in the United States.
What's different about what seems to go on in the U.S. versus other countries?
You know, it's been less violence, but it's only been different in magnitude and not in type. And what I mean by that is we were investigating in Iraq last year in Baghdad, where dozens of people were killed because tear gas canisters were fired directly at their heads, and they died in really gruesome ways. And unfortunately, we've seen that in the United States as well. It hasn't killed dozens. The magnitude is different. But tear gas has been fired directly at people. There's a journalist in Fort Wayne who lost an eye because of that. And so unfortunately, there's more similarities than I think we'd care to admit.
Early on in this interview, you said that what the police are doing in some instances here in the U.S. is unlawful. What makes what they're doing unlawful?
Right. So our standard for unlawful is international human rights law and the UN standards. And so inappropriate use of force, excessive use of force, beatings against peaceful protesters, the indiscriminate firing of rubber bullets into crowds, trapping people with tear gas, all of those are potentially unlawful acts by the police.
Brian Kastner is Senior Crisis Advisor for Amnesty International. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's been roughly 50 years since the first big wave of Indian immigrants started settling in the U.S., so maybe it was just a matter of time before an Indian-American musician made the cover of Rolling Stone India. But as the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, the cross-cultural fame comes with twice the potential for culturally insensitive mistakes.
Long before Swetha Rao was on the cover of Rolling Stone India, wearing a cape, sunglasses, and an attitude, she was a classical Indian dancer. Growing up in L.A., Rao's parents got her a live-in dancing instructor. She practiced 7 hours a day. By her teens, she was performing professionally before huge audiences in the U.S. and India and feeling out of place in school.
You know, I would travel and tour when I was a kid, you know. I would do all those things, so I was different, you know, than the people in my class.
She didn't feel like she belonged anywhere. Then she heard Lauryn Hill and the Fugees.
Ready or not, here I go home. You can't hide. Gonna find you and make you want me.
I would not exist as a rapper, an artist, without Lauryn Hill.
Hip-hop drew her in. After college, her dad supported her attempts to break into the music industry. Rao co-wrote songs for Iggy Azalea, Fall Out Boy, and Gwen Stefani. Then she released her own music video.
My parents love Celine Dion and Whitney Houston, so they thought I was kind of going to go in that direction, you know, and sing these, like, beautiful love songs. So it was more of a shock when I dropped Mute.
I had to put them on mute. I had to put them on mute. I had to put them on mute. I had to feed this fool, yeah. Had to go home and reboot. I'm running back with the guns, yeah. Talk all that shit that you know. I know you've been feeling that bomb, yeah.
Rao says the song expressed her frustration with studio executives who told her she was too Indian for American audiences.
I was like, I'm not going to stay in America where you keep telling me that nobody cares and nobody, you know, it won't work here and you're alienating the population. So if America didn't want to give me the platform, I was going to get it.
She moved to India, despite her parents' concerns, and took the stage name Rajakumari, which means princess. Rao says she wanted to prove that India had an authentic hip-hop scene and that she could be one of its pioneers. She also wanted to be a symbol of the Indian diaspora and its growing importance across the world.
The diaspora hasn't really had that kind of voice yet. Like, we have in some ways, but we haven't asserted ourselves with that kind of intensity. And if it didn't work, I was okay with that.
Rao had access to important players in the Indian music scene. They helped her succeed in the male-dominated hip-hop world. Soon, she was recording songs and performing to growing, massive crowds.
I definitely left a trail of Indian men in the industry that are very angry with the way that I behave.
Rao says she's creating a path for Indian women.
For Indian women, I definitely embody somebody fearless that doesn't care about the ideals of fair and lovely and be brown and beautiful and be thick and, you know, not be, you know, like all the things that Bollywood is now obsessed with and still be thriving.
Things were going great until something happened in 2018. Rao partnered on a song called Roots.
So I wrote a lyric and I said, like, I was talking about, like, India, and I said, pull up like the queen of Mumbai. You don't want no drama, Auntie G, come try. You don't want no drama, Auntie G, come try. Untouchable with the Brahmin flow. Untouchable with the Brahmin flow. Stop right there.
With those words, Rao had hit on one of India's most explosive and divisive issues, the Hindu caste system. The so-called untouchables are supposed to be the lowest caste. Brahmin is the highest and the most privileged caste. Rao's Brahmin, as are many people in the Indian diaspora. To some, her song was extolling the Indian equivalent of white supremacy in the U.S. Critics were harsh.
So it's like if you Google me and Google caste, it's like I am this like poster child for like hate. And it's like I am not that person at all, you know?
She says as an American, she was never educated about the caste system and didn't understand the implication of her words. Even though right now, untouchables, Muslims, and other minorities are building a civil rights movement and protesting persecution by the Hindu nationalist government.
It was just a poorly written lyric, I'd say now. It was done out of just naivety, not understanding like the depth of the pain.
Rao says she's gone through a process of educating herself and recognizing her own privilege. Despite the controversy, her success has continued to grow. She hosted the American Music Awards and became the first woman to headline India's biggest music festival. Just as the coronavirus pandemic hit, she filmed a music video for a new song called NRI. For non-resident Indians. Trying to rip my people, but they say I'm not their leader. And I'll ride up in the bleachers, feed up what y'all eating. Sorry that my story ain't Indian enough. In America, don't love me because I'm Indian as f***. Do you even know who you are? Tell me, what are you made of? As borders started closing, Rao rushed back to L.A., and now she's contemplating a future where it might be harder to go between the U.S. and India. She imagines that someday being cross-cultural will be normal everywhere.
The big dream has always been world domination. I imagine a life where you turn on a radio station and you hear a Hindi song. I see that. So as far as I go, wherever I go, I'm going to open the doors, leave them open behind me and pull in as many of my people as I can. And we are going to take up the space that you have not set for us. And my dream is to see that. I got peace all around me. Ain't no drama
these days. You won't see me when I'm coming. For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy. I got peace all around me. Ain't no drama these days. You won't see me when I'm coming because I'm changing my ways. Ain't no drama, drama. Ain't no drama, drama. I got peace all around me. Ain't no drama these days. You won't see me when I'm coming because I'm changing my ways. Can't kill the fun I'm on. This high I got on my own. Thank God I learned. Outside of the United States, Brazil is one of the epicenters of the coronavirus. Indigenous communities there are especially vulnerable. Hundreds of people have died, and more than 12,000 have been infected with COVID-19. But beyond the numbers, the pandemic is highlighting the grave inequality that indigenous populations face in northern Brazil. Michael Fox has this story.
Lucita Sanomá stands with a group of fellow indigenous Brazilians in a park in Boa Vista in northern Brazil. She wears a yellow tank top and a surgical mask. She is speaking in her native Sanomá language. She tells the president of the local Yanomami Indigenous Health Council that she's distraught and she needs his help. She says she can't go back home without the body of her dead son. I came here with my baby, she says, and I need you to help me take him home. She covers her face and cries while a man translates. This was the end of June. For more than a month, four mothers of the Sanomá tribe along the border with Venezuela had been looking for the bodies of their children in the Roraima state capital. They had originally traveled to Boa Vista to get treatment for their babies, who were sick with COVID-like symptoms. The children died at the hospital. Their bodies disappeared. The mothers, who could not speak Portuguese, did not know where they were taken. They say they were never told anything. The mothers searched for weeks, demanding answers. It inspired an article from a prominent journalist and a widespread campaign over social media. The hashtag Yanomami Children in Portuguese went viral. Indigenous activists like Alice Patachou demanded answers. She spoke to her 25,000 Twitter followers in a short video with her face painted and a large feather headdress.
Essas crianças precisam ser devolvidas para suas famílias. Não é só o povo Yanomami que sofre.
She said, These children need to be returned to their families. It is not only the Yanomami people who are suffering, but we are all with them. Meanwhile, investigative freelance journalist Emily Costa was trying to find the bodies. She spent days at the city's Campo da Saudade Cemetery. In a video she shared with the world, she walks behind a man in a green uniform through rows of recently filled mass graves. There are no tombstones or identification. It took her nearly a week to find the bodies of the four children. Three had been buried. Another was still being held at the city's legal medical institute. Her article was published with the news outlet Amazonia Real in the end of June. Finally, officials began to respond. They said that the children had been buried under suspicion of having COVID-19, but they never told the mothers. Journalist Emily Costa says, "We have to consider that we are living in the middle of a pandemic with protocols, and we have to be careful. But at the same time, we have to find middle ground where culture is also respected. I think it was immense violence against the mothers when they were not communicated with, nor did officials wait for any type of authorization." This case was particularly explosive because Yanomami funeral rites are extensive and extremely important for the tribe. Families grieve for months. The deceased are often cremated. The ashes are sometimes even consumed in a memorial feast. Without such ritual, there is no closure, neither for the dead nor the families. University of Brasilia anthropology professor Silvia Guimarães has worked with the Sanomá people for 15 years. She wrote to public prosecutors on behalf of the tribe shortly after the babies' bodies disappeared and says this case is indicative of the general treatment of indigenous peoples across the country. She says they treated these women as less than human, and this happens systematically every day. It's disrespectful, not sharing information, because these women are open. They understand what COVID-19 is now, but none of that was explained to them. They only learned after chasing after information. The Sanomá are a subgroup of the Yanomami people, whose territory composes the largest indigenous land in Brazil, but they have been increasingly under threat. 2 weeks ago, two Yanomami men were killed by illegal miners. Thousands of miners are currently on Yanomami land, polluting rivers, destroying forests, and putting native communities at risk from COVID-19. Nearly 200 Yanomami people have already been infected with the virus. Dario Copenaua is the vice president of the largest Yanomami association, Utucara. He says, "We believe there are more than 20,000 illegal miners working on Yanomami indigenous land. They are constantly coming and going via planes and helicopters. You can't imagine it. Each boat carries 10 or 20 people." In June, the Yanomami and their allies launched an international campaign to remove the illegal miners from their land. More than 330,000 people have signed the online petition. Last week, Copenaua traveled to Brasilia to demand action from Vice President Hamilton Mourão. According to Copenaua, Mourão promised to take decisive measures against the miners. But that may be a hard sell in a country led by President Jair Bolsonaro. He has supported legalizing mining on indigenous territories and encouraged invasions of tribal lands by effectively suspending fines for deforestation and environmental destruction. Back in Boa Vista, the bodies of two of the Sanomá children have now been returned to their families, but the other two babies still remain buried. It's unclear when their bodies will be returned home. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Sergio Dias of the Brazilian rock band Os Mutantes doesn't hold back his opinions about Bolsonaro.
We're going through a very hard moment because we're under a right-wing government. I won't say his name, it was not worth it, but it's really bad.
Since the 1960s, Os Mutantes has challenged the Brazilian government. Back then, they protested the military dictatorship. Today, it's Bolsonaro's authoritarian leadership. No matter the regime, Sergio Dias is compelled to speak out. The band's latest album is ZZYZX. It mixes political songs, but also tunes that take us somewhere beyond.
There's a lot of songs in the in the album that is refers to the universe and to like mutants and to space beings. And so it's very sci-fi. You can see it by the album cover also, this huge robot sending lasers through his eyes.
I can picture it now. Os Mutantes versus the despotic spaceman. We'll transport you with the band's track, Mutants Lonely Night. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
How do you think it's my evening tonight? What do you care if I'm never gonna find a kindred mind in this lonely night? Why would I have to get this desk that I...
From PRX.